Stay online after the podcast for a brief customer satisfaction survey. Hey, you're back again with Alan, Jordan, and Alex. We are junk connoisseurs. We're about to slip on the water wings and wade around the shallow end of the automotive pool and talk about a topic with you tonight.
Sounds good. Alan and I have something for you.
For Ooh, me?
Yes.
I wasn't realizing it was here.
Wait. Well, of course.
But you have to guess what it is.
I have to guess what
no,
it is.
No, you have to open that box over there that has flowers on it that I stole from my wife that you have to give back.
Ooh, fancy.
Yeah.
You know, the one you thoughtlessly set your microphone case on.
Yes.
Should I video?
No. Wait, are we going to post this?
I don't know.
What do we have here?
Oh, man.
Stay fresh, cheese bags.
Yes.
Wow. This is fantastic.
So for the viewers at home, it is a, I don't know, 3x5 throw that says stay fresh cheese bags on it in a very Oscar Mayer wiener sort of color palette and
somebody
lettering.
Get a picture and send so I can send it to the family. They're going to think it's hilarious. That's fantastic. No, thank you, guys.
You're welcome.
The Merry happiest cheese bag in the room. This is great.
That's awesome. Thank you, guys.
Yeah. I think someone sent me that, and I showed it to Alan, and we're like, yeah, we got to get that and give it to him.
We're going to have to get a good picture and put up on the Facebook page or something.
Sure.
All of us.
Oh, boy.
Well, the talk of measuring life, and you guys had mentioned now and in the past that I am the measuring life as far as project car habit. And
yeah, you were a useful measuring stick for that, yes.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you guys, I met a guy that puts all of us to shame.
And you bought something from
and
him.
I bought something from
him. Oh, yeah. How was your trip to see Bill?
I went and bought a project car that I hope to not project. But we know how, what's that called? Best laid plans of mice and men. This guy has a collection to envy. I'll put it that way. He has got some neat stuff. And I showed me, there were three buildings on the property where this Thunderbird that I bought, that's the project 82 Thunderbird. And we walked into one, he pointed at the other and said, I got some of my nicer stuff in there. Well, anyway, some of it's nice. And then we walked into the other building where he had a couple of the old Ford vans that are cut away to be like a Western hauler type truck. They've got like a gooseneck bed
Lux
on the back. Yeah, it's a van in front and gooseneck bed truck in the back.
Centurion? Is that?
They did the Bronco conversions. I think they may have done, there were some of these factory that were done too, but they take the van and just,
it has
basically
like
it's the back two-thirds of it is a flatbed, and then there's, when you couldn't get an extended cab pickup that easily, this was the solution for hauling.
Yeah. Yeah. The one I was thinking of was a dually, like E250.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it had like a fiberglass bed.
Yeah.
Style thing. Anyway, please continue.
Yeah. I saw at least three of those, maybe four of those on the property. there was, I forget what all I saw. There's some old neat Volvo, a couple of Jaguars that I couldn't even see because they were hidden behind the vans in the barn. An RX-7 and, which you will be selling soon, an early RX-7, early first generation. Yeah, you want it real bad, right, Jordan? We're all looking at Jordan. He's like, no, I said, I don't want one of these things. Yeah. Don't worry. We'll make sure you have more tartar sauce. Then we walked out of that, and there were several things in there. I can't even remember. I was overwhelmed by awesomeness and project goodness. And we walked out of that building, and as we're approaching the second building, which is a little smaller, there was a Miata out front. I was like, oh, you got a Miata? And he's started counting. He goes, yeah, I've got, And he's got out his fingers and started naming off color. Blue, white, red, white, yellow. I've got 7 Miata race cars. And then we walk into the other barn where there is a Caprice PPV, I believe. One of the fancy unobtainium Caprices we talked about in the previous episode. Oh, like a
2012?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He called it a wolf in sheep's clothing and said it would outrun just about anything else on the road right now. There was also a 66, I believe it was, Barracuda that will be for sale at some point soon, which is not a project. It's a nice, shiny, kind of burgundy, deep red car. And there was like a...
So not for us.
If I was a Mopar guy who wanted to have a nice Mopar someday, this is probably going to be a good way to get one.
Yeah, sure.
Just something to think about.
You don't need 2 kidneys, do you, Alan?
I don't need 2 A-bodies. I done got one.
Fair enough. Like,
now you...
Yeah.
Yeah. If I'm going to buy a Mopar in the near future, it's either going to be a giant Malaise cruiser or a giant 60s cruiser. If I'm going to buy something new.
Sure.
Because, you know.
Nope, and he had a 96 Firebird. It was the WS6. Not a Trans Am, a Firebird. Looked pretty neat. Will be for sale at some point. He said it's set up for autocross type duty. So this guy's a road racer and an autocrosser type guy. And he had a building, he said, 5 miles down the road, which I gathered was larger and had, probably a bunch of Miatas in it and stuff like that. So we hit it off and I expressed interest in keeping in touch with Bill because he's got some neat stuff and he does some neat stuff with his neat stuff. He also seems to be a fan of the let's buy 2 wrecked cars and make 1 daily driver out of it mentality. That was a fun experience. And that trip down to get that Thunderbird was worth it for that. I don't think that. So I bought an 82 Thunderbird with a 255 cubic inch V8, which is like a smaller bore version of the 302 Windsor and automatic overdrive transmission. It's worn out. Well, it's a neat old car, but it's sunbaked. That's its and hail damage. That's its primary ill. And as I said, I'm going to try real hard to just not fall in love with this car. Well, it's hard to fall in love with it.
She's a little ugly.
It's not hard to not love it, but it's also kind of quirky and
it's time to be an abusive foster parent, nitrous the ever-loving shit out of it, and let's see if we can, you know, scatter some rods.
I don't think it's going to take a whole lot.
So in thinking of, okay, if I was going to do something with this, what would it be? And I was like, well, you could build a drag car out of it if you wanted to put an engine in it and tires and wheels and a bunch of other stuff. Or we could build one of these cheap challenge road race, you know, Champ Car or 24 Hours of Lemons kind of deal, but it's got an automatic transmission. And I mean, the body's great for it because it's not really worth saving. It's not desirable. It doesn't have cancer, but it does have a few little rust spots here and there, but it's not bad rust and it's hail damaged.
Now, this is the kind of thing if you show up to a Lemons race, they look at you and say, no penalty laps if you are not obviously cheating.
Right.
Because that's the thing. If we take my $200 Miata to a Lemons race and they say, oh, look, another red Miata, you start 50 laps down.
It's yeah.
Like, okay.
Yeah.
But if you show up with some god-awful specimen.
Yes.
But the thing is that it's...
But it's a Fox body.
It's a Fox body. Mm-hmm.
It is a Fox body, and all the pieces and parts are available, and they bolt right on. It's not magic to make these things get around a road course. It'll look funny and there'll be a weighted disadvantage, I assume. It's got a little longer wheelbase and probably a little bit heavier body, but it's not a Thunderbird of any other generation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They
were huge. They got this, then they got big again.
But the big con. And
then they turned into a Jaguar thing, but whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. But the big con to it all is that it's got an automatic transmission. And sure, you can easily, I've done it, you can easily convert it to a manual transmission, but you can't cheaply convert it to a manual transmission. Even relatively. I mean, you can, but.
And getting a T5 to survive an endurance race behind a V8 is probably a big ask.
Well,
Maybe not a 255.
Yeah, well, but if you're
via torque limited.
Yes, a 255, and that's the deal. That thing, I say it all the time. It probably doesn't make enough power to hurt itself. You could probably put some gaskets on it and set the valves and go run. It's probably got a cam that.
It's basically
it
flat.
It might have a camshaft. Yeah. To get out a magnifying glass to see if it's actually eccentric at all. I don't know. That 255 is the least desirable, I'm going to say with confidence, of any Ford V8 ever. Am I wrong? Definitely of any Windsor.
Oh, yeah. You're
definitely right on the Windsor. I don't know enough about the Y block. So
I feel like Y blocks or the MELs, something maybe early
on. The MELs were huge.
Early on. I mean, yeah, but.
They've at least got provenance, like in racing and stuff, right? No?
I don't know. The MEL.
I don't know.
Oh, the Y block. The MEL is.
The Y block did for a while.
Yeah, I think they use that. That was maybe the first engine that went into a T Bird.
I think so. You get into Fords, and I don't know Fords from.
The MEL was.
Many engine families.
Probably, and I'm guessing, is Mercury Edsel Lincoln.
So it's a
big block.
Okay. I don't
But different from the FE, which is the
other big block.
But the E in FE is Edsel. So okay. I think it's Ford Edsel.
Okay.
So maybe the MEL is what was in between the FE block and the 385, so the 429, 460, but there was only like 6 years in there. Like, there's no reason.
Ford did some really weird stuff with engines, didn't they?
Shut up, Mopar guy. Alan's throwing me looks.
Two.
Yeah, yeah.
Or a big block.
But they did all sorts of other weird shit.
Oh, plenty of other weird shit. But yeah, mostly small good. Block, big block. Yeah. I mean, before that, well, okay. If you're going to be fair, they also had. If we're going into the 50s, there are four different V8 families because you've also got the original Hemi. You've got the Poly V8, which is loosely related to the later small block, but.
Plastic V8?
Polyspheric because.
Oh, is it a combustion?
It's a combustion chamber thing because, we got a Hemi. So what's this? It's a polysphere. What the fuck is that? Just
marketing
just
mumbo jumbo. Yeah.
Mumbo, perhaps.
No, the
jumbo, perhaps not.
The only thing I specifically remember MELs being in, though, are like the 20 feet plus long Lincolns.
Yeah.
So yeah. I think there was a 430. I think they were designed to compete with the Caddy. 425 500.
Yeah, okay.
Engine platform.
Yeah, I'm not real familiar with that in the Fords. I just never followed them.
I don't think they did anything except for possibly be smooth better than an FE or a 385. Yeah.
That's what I don't get is they produced at the same time they produced at least like three different engine families that overlapped with exactly what they did.
Yeah.
Because you could get an FE in a big car. You could get an MEL. You could get a 385. You know, they produce these all at various times. The giant torque monster V8 came in like three flavors, and it just doesn't make any sense why they didn't just consolidate down to one.
You know? I do think that the FE was being wound down when the 385 was coming in because the 429 and the 428 didn't really have any overlap. There were still some big trucks that used FE engines, the 360, for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they were – I don't know if you could get in the same platform a 360 or a 390 and a 429. Like, yeah. I don't know if those were
directly
available.
Here's a random thought that comes – not a random thought. Here's what comes to mind when we're talking about Ford having all these different engines and now you say, why didn't they just consolidate them down? Well, they did. This might have been the heyday of each brand having its own engine architecture a la Buick, Oldsmobile, Cadillac. Pontiac when they were motor companies.
Well, yeah, when they were each their own individual company, you know, GM each, especially in the 60s, 50s, 60s, 70s. I mean, but all the other companies, except for Chevy, you get one design at a time. Mm-hmm. And then they took that away from them and said, nope, here's a small block Chevy.
Right.
But, you know, the Olds, was the Pontiac was one V8, although I think they got their own six cylinder. No, they did, because they had the overhead cam six. And then Old's got its V8. What you so excited about?
I got it correct. The MEL was the Mercury Edsel Lincoln.
Yeah.
And it was a replacement for the Y block.
Yeah.
Which was not the same as the replacement for the Y block that the FE was, which was the Ford Edsel.
Hmm. Okay.
I don't understand.
I don't either. I know, man. It's like
and Wikipedia says predecessor, Lincoln Y block. Successor, Ford 385.
Yeah.
You're just going to ignore the FE engine? Anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. No.
Well, and then, yeah, so that was just a thought. Well, this was back when they made lots of engines. They had lots of resources. Hey, we'll come up with this design. We'll try it out for a while. And they used them. And then later, we saw the demise of the many different engine designs and the corporate consolidation to where GM had their corporate small block where they're putting – well, and even before that, they were putting Oldsmobile engines in Pontiacs, and they were putting Pontiac engines in who knows what. I think
Olds was the last non-Chevy V8 that got the axe, because you could still get an Olds engine in like a Cutlass or a Grand Prix into like the 80s.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so you could get a G-body with a specific Olds engine?
Yeah, I think a 307.
Which
is not a 307 Chevy. No, by any means. But yeah.
307. That's what I pulled out of the Buick Regal wagon that originally had a diesel in it.
But it was a 307 Olds, not a 307 Chevy.
It was a 307 Olds that came in it. And now I have put in a small block Chevy 350.
Stop throwing your stones at Ford. Chevy.
Well,
I'll continue to throw them. I mean, as long as we know who did it right, I mean.
Toyota?
Yes, Toyota. Known for its V8 engine architecture. Yes,
actually,
I know.
Actually,
in the 60s, they were not.
Lovely V8.
It's a lovely V8, and it's the only one they make, and it goes in anything that needs a V8.
Yeah, that's smart.
Well, they're on their second version.
Anywho.
But one at a time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, they wrung the complete snot out of the UZ series, and then they were like, let's do a UR series, and we're going to make variations and put it in everything.
Yeah. Jordan, are we talking about a car tonight?
No.
Okay. More about V8s. More diatribes.
So, to transition to our vehicle tonight, your first tidbit is never available with V8.
Okay.
Bye, Alex.
Not yet. No, I'm not checked out yet. Was it rear-wheel drive at least?
No.
Okay. I'll catch up with you guys later. Who's going to edit this episode? I'm going to have to listen to this 48 times. All right. So it's front-wheel drive?
Yes. Okay. I do think you will have at least a certain amount of appreciation for it.
I'm sure I will.
You could get it with a manual transmission, though. So
okay.
At least we got
one out of three. It ain't great.
Yeah. So, it was available in four body styles.
All right. Was dirigible one of them?
Depends on your definition of dirigible, but I believe the answer is no.
Okay, it wasn't like helium or hydrogen filled?
No.
Okay.
No.
Then no.
I mean, they had a lot of specialty models, so maybe.
All right. Was this a U.S. domestic produced and branded car?
It was a foreign car, though it was produced on domestic soil for a portion of its life.
Okay. So that's got me leading me towards, and I may be wrong, the likes of Honda, Toyota, Subaru. Does Nissan do U.S. production?
They do, but they only started that relatively recently. Mm. Is this foreign company European or Asian?
It is European.
Okay.
Is this vehicle the Volkswagen Rabbit?
It is.
Boom! I'm really good at this game!
My eardrum. So, yes, this is, for the American market, the Mark I Rabbit.
Okay.
Globally known as the Golf. Which, since we're on the topic, apparently marketing in Germany thought that Americans played too much of the game of golf and that it would be confusing, so they named it the Rabbit.
They don't think much of us, do they?
No. Well, also this, all of these marketing discussions were happening like less than 30 years after the end of World War II. Well, so a lot of people were maybe not fans, but anyway.
Junk Connoisseurs is brought to you by Sock Drawer Financial. Sock Drawer Financial is a service that helps hide money from your significant other to spend on hobbies, vices, or anything really that's not considered wise or responsible. You've tried the giant jar or jug full of nickels and pennies, and you've tried simply hiding it under the mattress or inside the toilet tank. But these antiquated methods are boring and risky. Besides, who has pocket change anymore? With Sock Drawer Financial, you choose the amount you'd like to embezzle from yourself, and our algorithms, created by a recently paroled forensic accountant slash state's witness, extract a small amount of money from your account. They do this in multiple transactions every month, disguised as everyday innocuous purchases like subscriptions, charitable contributions, or groceries. This money is then safely stored for you in your choice of financial instruments, treasury bonds, Chipotle gift cards, burlap bags full of nickels. We really have a lot of options. We even offer a backup plan for if your loved ones find out. You have the option to create a secondary account that can be labeled Secret Gift for My Darling Spouse, or Surprise Vacation Fund, or Spa Treatment. As an extra contingency plan, these funds are also fully transferable to your divorce lawyer of choice. And we know what you're thinking, but it's not illegal. You're simply skimming your own money and hiding it so you can use it selfishly. When you think about it, it's barely even immoral. A fib at worst. So what are you waiting for? Come join us at Sock Drawer Financial and get started today. Sock Drawer Financial, we didn't say it was a good idea.
So yeah, we're talking about the 1974 to 1984, I believe. I actually didn't write that down. I'm sorry. Mark 1 Volkswagen Golf Rabbit thing. It was available in four body styles. So you had your two basics, your three-door hatch, your five-door hatch. You had a cabriolet, which in the U.S. was just the convertible because apparently we're boring. And also the VW truck, later known as the Caddy.
Yes.
Seems as though that was not the original name. It was just like, hey, do you want a rabbit with a bed? Developed for the American market, built here for a couple of years. Then it was continued on. I think the manufacturing went back to Germany for a while, and then it went to Brazil and whatever. So the Rabbit is the first foreign vehicle to be produced on U.S. soil.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
There was a tiny little piece of time in the 1920s when Rolls-Royce was producing cars here, but we can ignore that because it's they made probably like 12 cars. Mm-hmm. It's Rolls-Royce. It was the 20s.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in 1978, Volkswagen had set up a deal with the Pennsylvania state government to buy a shuttered and not completely finished Chrysler factory. Because they had started this factory in Pennsylvania in the late 60s and decided it wasn't viable. I'm sure that we can have our local Chrysler expert talk on how Chrysler was doing in the early 70s. Yeah. I mean,
not like everybody else.
Nobody was doing great.
No.
But by the late 70s, there was this giant empty factory. Volkswagen had set up this deal where Pennsylvania gave him like $30 million to finish the factory and gave him like $100 million in tax incentives to come set up there. So this became this locally produced vehicle. Of course, we'll kind of get back to that in a minute.
Yeah.
So the main things that we could talk about here are everybody's fond memories of the Rabbit, and it was this tiny tossable vehicle, and you could get the GTI later on, and it was the introduction of the hot hatch, which I think is safe to say that we're all fans of.
Yeah.
It may not be a V8 and rear-wheel drive, but if you're going to drive a front-wheel drive car, having it be light and tossable and a manual transmission is really appealing.
Yeah,
able to go around corners on three wheels for less friction. That's good.
It was the introduction of the hot hatch everywhere but England.
Sure.
Because the Mini Cooper was the hot hatch, was the prototype.
Yeah. But some
of us need a vehicle large enough to haul adult humans.
Right. Yeah. Like the Cooper has limited accessibility and approachability just because it's tiny. Mm-hmm. And it just doesn't work on American highways. Nope. And yeah, it's,
this was the formula scaled up to 120% scale, which makes it a very small car by American standards, but it is completely useful to do everything that you could otherwise do with a full-size car, you know?
Was this a functional replacement for the Volkswagen Beetle Type 1?
Yes. Bug? Yeah. So in the 50s, Volkswagen started to see things in the press about the Beetle being potentially long in the tooth, which...
In the 50s.
In the 50s. Yeah. So it was
we'll 19- get right on that.
Yeah. In 1958, there was a news article talking about how the Beetle was possibly in need of a replacement. So time went by and the Beetle continued to sell, I don't know, several million units a year,
right.
Or whatever. And then 1976, I believe it was, 1966, the production or the purchasing numbers of Beetles like fell 60% and just continued to drop throughout the rest of the 60s into the early 70s. So Volkswagen started freaking out and they went through several hundred design options to replace the Beetle. Most of them were rear engine, rear wheel drive, air cooled, like just
evolutions of the Volkswagen Type 1 Beetle bug.
Right. They were just going to continue the same thing they were doing, but introduce probably higher safety standards mm-hmm. and modern amenities that you yes. would get with any vehicle. In the late 60s, Volkswagen purchased Audi and NSU. NSU is another German auto manufacturer that was rolled into Volkswagen in the late 60s. And they started producing the K70, which was just an NSU product that had VW badges on it. Mm. It was very similar to what Audi was producing. So front engine, front wheel drive, water cooled, but it had this old engine design that NSU had been using for a long time. So they realized that this was the direction they needed to go, though. That water cooling and front wheel drive just made more sense in today's market. It was more efficient to manufacture. It allowed for smaller proportions of the vehicle. But everything they were getting from Audi was this odd longitudinal. So that means the engine was pointed from the front of the car to the back of the car. And then it had a transmission that Audi still uses this style today that is behind the engine. But then you end up with a super long hood because the engine's hanging out way in front of the suspension and the tires.
We call that the reverse 911.
Yeah, kind of. So VW decided they were going to take this engine that Audi had developed. They'd purchased the rights. Like, they'd purchased the company. They had access to it. They had a couple sizes, an 1100cc and a 1500cc. They were going to turn it sideways, and they were going to make the Golf and the Scirocco. And the Scirocco started production a little early, but it started at Karmann. And it was used to kind of iron out the details of the Golf on its way to the massive production numbers that they were going to have when it started production at the actual VW facility a couple months later. So the funny thing is that I always think of the Rabbit as sort of VW's introduction to modern vehicle manufacturing. But it was actually their third car because the Passat had come out in 73 and the Scirocco had come out in 74 just before the Golf had started production in 74. And the Scirocco was built on the Golf chassis and blah, blah, blah. But it still is the highest production numbers of any of those three from the era and still what kind of drove them to the success of today. So they start shipping this car all over the world. It's a big sales success. They have gained a lot of the ground back they'd lost from the VW, and they were getting a lot of positive press. It was lightweight. It was fun to drive. A small team was sort of doing evening work and came up with the concept of the GTI, where they took the big motor from the Passat and they finessed it. And in the European market, as always, it made 110 horsepower and came out in 1976, which in a car that weighs 1,800 some odd pounds is quite spicy.
For 1976, that was groundbreaking. Like 110 horsepower in an economy car was like, nobody done that.
Well, I think what I saw, 0 to 60 was 8.6 seconds, and that's on really terrible 1970 tires. Of course, we didn't get the GTI until the 80s, and it was only 90 horsepower, but it was still quite fast. Like one of the things I saw said that it was for 83 or 84, it was a second faster to 60 than a Trans Am, which the Trans Am was kind of gutted by then, or completely gutted. But it still says something that those are even in a ballpark.
That's impressive.
You're probably looking at 9.5 to 60.
Yes, that's what it was. It was
From the A1 GTI here.
9.7.
They also got a really close ratio transmission.
It's five gears.
They sing to you on the highway. I had one of those in my Scirocco when I was in high school.
Yep.
Boy, you didn't want to go much faster than about 80. You didn't want to cruise any faster than 80, but it's fun getting there.
You shouldn't be cruising faster than 80 anyways, Alan.
Dude, I was 17.
So, the base price in 1974 for a Volkswagen Golf, $3,139, which is 18 grand today. So that was
We keep coming back to that. Everything we look at that's at the bottom end, the economy end of the scale, comes back to about 18 grand in today's dollars. 16, 18, somewhere in that range. So it really was the value vehicle at the time.
Well, and that would get you a 1.6 liter carbureted four cylinder that made 70 horsepower and took 12 to 14 seconds to get to 60. So,
which compared to that same money spent on a Chevette or a Vega or a Pinto was probably going to get you something that was a lot lighter, just as fast, and handled with verve, as opposed to...
Well, and got better fuel economy
better fuel economy.
Yeah.
And that's not even getting into the diesels, which got fantastic fuel economy.
And made 50 horsepower and took 20 seconds to get to 60.
Oh, Lord, were they slow.
It's amazing they could manage 60. But, so the whole point was is that they were trying to make something that's lightweight and fun to drive and sort of lived up to the spiritual successor as the spiritual successor of the Beetle, which is arguably the most influential car of all time.
What?
The Beetle? I mean,
it's,
not the
diesel. It's arguably so.
I would say it is second on the list.
What's your first?
Model T.
Okay, fair. That's
I mean.
Okay, so the Model T would be sort of the first time somebody had built the car correctly.
Right.
The Bug would probably be the first time somebody built on such a massive scale a car for everyone. Not that the Model T wasn't also sort of that.
No, I agree.
But literally anybody could hop in a Beetle and just drive it away.
Yeah.
Well, and that's what was so endearing about the Beetle in retrospect. It's endearing. At the time, it was just a car, right? I don't know that people thought it was a fantastic
It was utilitarian transportation, but it really, especially in Europe, it brought transportation into the range of the average person. And it was, you know, it brought comfortable transportation because you could maybe before that you could afford in England, you could afford an Austin 7 in the 30s, but it made 15 horsepower, topped out at 40 miles an hour and didn't really have any weather protection. You know, in Germany, you could, or France, you could afford a Citroën 2CV, but it sucked to drive and was good for maybe 50 miles an hour. And the Beetle, by the time they hit their stride, was actually usable in almost any situation. It would haul four people.
And but it was an appliance.
Exactly. It was an appliance. Mm-hmm. It was an appliance that was still had a little bit of soul. Yeah. And the Golf absolutely carried that torch.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And
until they tried to build it here.
Yep, I'm getting there. So overall, the Mark One, they made 6 million units. So it was not as many as the Beetle, but it was still a lot because there were almost 12 million.
Is that all the Mark One chassis, or is that just Golfs and GTIs?
Because
the Jetta was also the same thing, just with a trunk.
It's probably everything.
The Scirocco was the same thing, but a little sexier.
They made like a couple hundred thousand Sciroccos.
Yeah, they're not nearly as common.
I was just curious. I found a number. It said 6 million.
Yeah. But it was and a large
worldwide.
Still, yeah,
it was a large production
for sure
for over 10 years. I mean, well, and then they kept building them. I'm sorry, I'm stepping on your mojo, Jordan.
You can hop into that later. I didn't continue on past the local, i.e. U.S. and European death of the Mark One.
I think in South Africa, they kept building the Mark One Golf as the City Golf until 2004.
Yeah. I saw in my... So there is a lot of history available from Volkswagen Group itself, from owner groups, and it's so much to process. I could have spent 3 days doing nothing but reading stuff on this. But the start of the Volkswagen Auto Group's like year by year breakdown of what was happening in their company at that time for 1972, it was, we set up the Nigerian arm of Volkswagen and they started producing Beetles. Like, so Germany was going to stop producing Beetles, but they were going to continue to make them all over the world. Mm-hmm. And I'm not surprised to hear that they did the exact same thing with the Golf. So in 1975, the Golf got second place for European Car of the Year. Do you want to guess what got first? Alan may have an idea.
Is it the Rover SD1?
No.
Ah, damn.
It's the Citroen CX.
I think I actually knew that, but yeah.
Well, we just talked about weird French cars recently. Let's see. Important things to add while we're here. So, yes, let's get back to that Pennsylvania situation. So, VW decided to make the bold move based on some tax implications, because there was a 10% markup mm-hmm. on foreign imports of any kind, not just the chicken tax, as we've discussed before.
Right.
And the... how the Deutschmark versus the U.S. dollar was in the late 70s and the way that the oil crisis had shook out, and decided they were going to open a factory in the U.S. Pennsylvania gave them a whole bunch of money to do it, gave them a bunch of tax credits so they could get profits off the ground quicker, asked them to improve the grounds around the factory. So, you know, there was some reinvestment there. And everything was going great, right up to the point where the person in charge of the factory, who was getting to make the decisions about what the Golf was like, said, let's change it for the American market, even though it was already a sales success. Mm. Like, so that what they changed some of the exterior styling, which probably some of it was related to crashworthiness and whatever. They cheapened the interior. Because you need to do that on an $18,000 car. I don't understand that one at all.
Didn't they take the tack out?
I didn't see that, but I wouldn't be surprised. They made the suspension softer, which, not the point.
Yeah.
Like, it's just a hot mess. They just neutered the car in every way, and they turned it into a Dodge Omni.
Yeah.
Which, by the way... Volkswagen had sold Dodge, I don't know if they knew they were doing it, but they sold them 100 Rabbits, which they then reverse engineered into the Omni.
Not true, but let's play.
I'm just saying what the internet told me, and the internet never lies.
Yeah, okay. The Dodge Omni was developed from the Talbot Horizon, which was developed about the same time as
Eastern European Talbot?
French. For English.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you're thinking of Trabant, The Talbot Horizon, which was developed very similar at the very basically the mid 70s, everybody was going to a front drive hatchback.
Oh, yeah, no, it made sense.
So they developed that from the Talbot being Chrysler's European, your Talbot and Simca were Chrysler's European arms at the time. They developed this, and then the US said, hey, that's cool, let's develop something similar. What they did was they sort of ported that over, made a few design changes. However, I will give you that in 1978, when they introduced the Omni here, they did not have an engine for it. So they bought the 1.7 from Volkswagen. Yeah. And like they bought an engine and transmission that. And just slapped it in the Omni and said, it's good. Yeah, it was okay.
It's fine.
They were good cars.
Like,
given what they were, but yeah.
This is literally information I pulled off of the internet and YouTube like three hours ago. Right. So I'm not going to die on this hill.
No. But the Westmoreland plant was just kind of the biggest dumb, great idea on its face and C-minus for execution that you can think of. The cars were terrible. There was no quality control.
Awesome.
They fell apart, which that was the one thing that if you bought a German Rabbit, it was screwed together really well.
Right. Yeah.
It may have felt a little flimsy. It was a little flimsy, but it was put together well and the quality control was good. And they started selling, that was when they eventually started selling the Westphalia edition Golf. You could buy a Pennsylvania Golf or you could buy the Westphalia edition, which means this one was built in Germany.
It doesn't mean it has a pop-up camper on the top.
No,
oh, okay.
No. It was just, yeah, there, no pop-up camper, but better, wow. Better everything else.
And the edition just meant it was built in Germany.
So did they go back to the round headlights with the Westphalia? Because I think the U.S. market ones were mostly rectangular.
I think in the U.S. they were all square headlights, except the Cabriolet got round headlights.
That was because that one was still built in Germany.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
I am not certain, but I think they all got, because they all got U.S. bumpers, uh-huh. And I think they still got U.S. Square headlights.
Okay.
Which was not great for the looks, but that was what people wanted in the 70s. I think that was just kind of the way everything was going in the 70s with square headlights, you know?
Yeah. Well, the BMW did it with the 2002, and the round headlight ones look awesome, and the square headlight ones look terrible.
Yeah.
It's amazing what tiny details can really mess up a car.
Yeah. Is there any... Okay. Sidebar. Is there anything that looks better with rectangular headlights than round? There probably is, but...
Not... As far as the rectangular headlights that you're thinking of, mm-hmm. I can't imagine the answer is yes, unless it's something with pop-up headlights.
Okay.
So, I will say, the early Sciroccos got... The upmarket ones got four round headlights. Mm-hmm. The lower market ones got what they call TV screen headlights. They're bigger than I think what you get in America on anything, but they're a big rectangular headlight. And I like those with the rectangular headlights. Really? I think the round ones look good too, but it's a six of one, half a dozen of the other situation.
Those are more angular than the two box design you get in the Golf. But like in 1978, the F-150 that's sitting outside, you could get it with round headlights or square head or rectangular headlights.
Yeah.
And the rectangular ones look awful.
Yeah. The Dodge did the same thing in that era, and the round headlight grill looks so much better.
Yeah.
But the square headlight, the rectangular headlights were the upmarket option.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know. Just it seems like if there's a choice in most body styles, it looks better round.
But, yep.
Yeah, that's an off-the-cuff observation.
Hang on.
Yeah, I think that's appropriate for this this discussion because this model had that exact thing. And
right, my barn's full of square headlights. YJ, Fox Body.
the YJ would be like the classic example of why did you do that? Yes. And they figured it out and went back eventually.
The YJ Jeep, when they went to rectangular headlights and nobody liked them, they still don't. But now that I've got one, I can appreciate it. It's a drawback, but it's there.
It made the Jeep more accessible.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Made it cheap.
So the... In 1980, the Caddy came out. It was produced in the Pennsylvania factory. It was this weird thing that actually positively came from American production because they're really neat. And they started this whole like micro truck thing.
Was that a US specific model?
Yes. Okay. And it eventually was, I think when production ceased in Pennsylvania, they started producing them in Germany. And then eventually it all moved to Brazil when they figured out the Brazilian market really liked
a pickup truck.
Yeah, a really fuel efficient utility vehicle. Mm-hmm. So that factory, things did not go well. Eventually it was shut down and all production moved back to Germany with, I think they produced some Mark IIs in Pennsylvania for a few years because I think it was the late 80s that factory had shut down. But no, the quality control issues and the poor judgment and lack of understanding of their target market kind of put the nail in the coffin of that one. So, yeah, Mark One Golf.
Mark
One Golf. It's cool. We eventually, in 83, I think, got the GTI. It had the larger motor from the Passat, which was, I think, a 1.8 liter. And produced all of 90 horsepower, and we didn't get the 112 horsepower version that was available in Europe.
Wouldn't pass emissions.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they didn't have to have a catalytic converter.
Yeah, so you could go buy yourself a 140-horse Malaise V8 that almost certainly was worse on emissions.
Yeah.
Just due to displacement.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Couldn't have that.
But this was also – this absolutely kicked off the front drive tuner craze in the 80s.
Oh yeah.
Because you could go to any number of people who would grind you a cam identical to the one you could buy it or better than the one you could buy in the German GTI. And you could, you know, spend an afternoon popping it in and your American GTI would run pretty good.
Yeah.
They did have Alex's favorite fuel delivery system.
K-Jetronic.
Yep.
Which I'm sure was removed for like dual Webers and all sorts of stuff.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Because I don't know how well K-Dretronic would tolerate massive camshaft changes. And I don't know.
I think you could make it work, but I think a lot more people were just happier plopping a Weber 36 on it.
Well, yeah. Because
it was much more tunable. It was within the realm of people who already knew how to do that. Right. You know?
Yeah, I imagine that there are ways to make a K-Jetronic push more fuel, but I also imagine it's not something that you can do in your garage most of the time.
I don't know.
I've never looked into it.
We couldn't make it push the fuel it was supposed to push to the stock engine in my Scirocco. That was the biggest issue we had with it.
Yeah.
All right, so let's get to the would you buy it round. Who wants to go first?
I would buy a gray market GTI, like an actual European one. That's probably 25 grand I'm not going to spend. But of all of the ones I read about today, it's that or a Caddy, the truck. Like, the Caddies are just cool.
They're neat. They're mostly diesels, though. I mean, I think the diesel was like 4-1 in terms of how diesel versus gas.
Wow.
But it's easily swappable if you're wanting to spend some time, you know.
Yeah.
And at one point, they made so many Volkswagens. And I remember for a long time in the 90s and aughts, the hot ticket was go buy the 2.0 single cam out of, well, anything they made up until like 2016. That motor was still in the Jetta. Put that in whatever you had. And now you have 115, 120 horsepower instead of the 50 you got from the stocker.
Yeah.
And they were everywhere. They're not really, you know, A1s really aren't there anymore. They're just kind of gone. But yeah, buy a Caddy.
Yeah.
What about you, Alan? Would you buy one of these?
I haven't bought a Golf or a Scirocco. I had a Scirocco and I would buy.
It's kind of the same thing.
It is. Essentially, it's just it's the same platform. Mm-hmm. I absolutely would. They're neat. They drive with joie de vivre is probably the best way to describe it. They just feel like they're put together right. And okay. they're always looking for more. Like, you're like, yeah, you know, you can Sign says 45, but I'm pretty sure you could take this corner at 50. You know, it's okay, cool. Let's try it, you know. They're neat.
Well, I think it's also worth mentioning that your experiences were with almost certainly German-built.
It's true.
Scirocco.
Yes.
Because Carmen was the one who was putting those together. So not quite the same experience as somebody who was buying a 1980.
I'm not sure I'd try to buy an American-built Rabbit, you know, if I could find one. But I would absolutely go for a GTI. And I wouldn't turn my nose up at the right American-built Rabbit. But, you know, they're not perfect. They have – I still remember we jacked the front end up to change the oil. And for some reason, we had both doors open and neither door would latch. At that point, it's like, oh, well, okay.
From anything. Actually, I'm a little surprised at a Volkswagen having that problem. Yeah. But I know any of the U.S. stuff I had from about that time frame. Oh, not a chance.
Yeah.
Flappy.
I also remember my dad doesn't listen to this podcast, which is good. It was actually my dad's Scirocco that we co-owned it. But when we were having problems with the aforementioned K-Jet one time at the video rental store, I got so mad at it because it wouldn't run for longer than 3 seconds that I got out and kicked it in front of the taillight as hard as I could and put a basketball-sized dent in the side of the car. And my girlfriend just looked at it and was like, oh, what are you going to do? And I'm like, pop the hatch open, pull the little cardboard thing back, just kind of massage it back to mostly straight with my hand. And sorry, Dad.
They were built light of thin metal. Yeah. That was the point, right?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Alex, how about you?
What?
Would you own one?
What?
No.
Okay. No, I'm not going to go looking for one of these. And even if a deal fell in my lap, I know two suckers who probably want it more than me, unlike Thunderbirds of similar vintage.
It took you getting to the point where that thing was like scrap value.
Yes.
Haul it away. I've done,
But one years ago when I was in a spot where I had zero money to even accept it if it was free, I think I was offered a good deal on a Caddy with a diesel, and I was interested in running a vehicle on vegetable oil, straight vegetable oil, not just biodiesel. Yeah, and I still didn't come home with it, but again, it wasn't a good point in life for me to. That was kind of interesting. I know they're slow as molasses, but they're kind of neat little diesel, you know. Don't see many of those around anymore, any of these. You just don't see an old Volkswagen Rabbit Golf around anymore.
Well, I think that they fall into the same category as a lot of other economy cars from this time period, as they just got thrashed and thrown away.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You didn't have a ton of people who were interested in taking care of it and keeping it in the garage, and, you know, they're just gone.
Yeah. And by the time they got to a point where it was like, oh, they made a lot of these and we can tune them and they can be an enthusiast car, there just weren't that many left around. They'd been crushed and that sort of thing.
The stance community, which I don't want to yuck anybody's yum, but, you know, massive camber, tiny tires stretched on wide wheels.
Uh-huh.
I think they found Volkswagens before they found anything else. Yeah. And I think that those guys modified / ruined a lot of what otherwise might be a savable driver, you know?
Well, so a little bit of a guess on why that occurred is Europe and Germany in particular is very strict on the way that you can modify cars. Mm-hmm. So you couldn't touch the engines at all.
Huh.
So it could be that if you're going to do something,
that's how you're going to express yourself.
you're going to, it has to be suspension tuning, and the tire thing is like a caricature of the way that you make race car tires work. But, no, I think a lot of that came from just, the way that European, governing bodies regulate automotive modification.
Yeah. Could be
interesting.
Did you check on pricing?
For now? Like how much they're worth now? The world is in crazy, insane place. So as of 2 years ago, a really nice one was like a Concours level GTI was under $30,000.
Hmm.
I don't know if that's was accurate then because it was 2021 and that was the worst time period to consider buying a vehicle of any sort of interest. But no, I think you could probably get a nice running GTI from $15,000 to $20,000, maybe a little less. As we said, though, there aren't that many left, and any place where there's rust, they're all gone.
Yeah.
That's why we don't see them.
They get rust hard.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, as you said, the sheet metal's thin, and...
Yeah. I mean, they weren't built to be a... Well, Volkswagen can probably do a better job than most, but they weren't built to last forever. They were built to get through a warranty period, maybe a little bit longer, and then you could buy a new one from the company that makes them and makes profit on them.
Yeah. Yeah, they didn't do the thing that another division of Volkswagen was getting into, Porsche, where they were galvanized dipping all of the bodies.
Well, and I mean, look at what they had to compete against in the 70s and 80s. Cars didn't, I mean, 100,000 miles a car was worn out, and that was the expectation.
1983, cars and bids from 2021. 1983 GTI, 96,000 miles, clean stocker, sold for $4,700.
That seems unreasonably cheap.
It does.
Not to me, but okay.
For something that is probably getting to the point of being collectible.
Well, we're talking about it. It is collectible. I mean, as collectible as it's ever going to be.
Right. So one of the history review videos I watched prep was talking about how they had gone through a friend of theirs that did automotive valuations, you know, like Hemmings does or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I got my pricing.
Yeah.
But they were discussing how they fully expect like early Mark Ones and European GTIs to be the kind of thing that show up to Pebble Beach in the next 20 years because they're rather instrumental in the way that the automotive community has been, and they're not going to get frowned on quite as much as if you show up in a, I don't know,
Matador.
Yes, a Matador.
Sorry, AMC, you're the whipping boy.
Well, there's nobody here to defend them.
That's true.
So, no, they're neat. That's all. I don't know. I thought they were a pretty influential vehicle. Yeah. Kind of.
Yeah.
So we can't see it from here either, which makes me wonder.
I did not buy it. Let me think about this for a moment. Oh, hold on. Let me think about this for a minute. Aside from a Porsche 944, I've never owned anything from Volkswagen.
I think I've had the Scirocco, and I think that's the only VW I've owned. Come close a couple times to buying them. But yeah.
I think all I've had was that Project Bug, that air-cooled Bug that I moved along because I decided it was more Project than I was going to get to.
Mm-hmm.
Anywho, we've beaten this to death, guys.
Yeah.
Well, I agree with you. We've beaten this into the ground. We've had a good conversation. Lots of fun side conversations.
Alex?
Yeah.
Time to read your blanket.
Oh.
What's it say?
I got a blanket tonight, and it says, "Stay fresh, cheese bags." That blanket will keep me fresh.
I mean, the knob is way turned down compared to...
He's been tasting the knob. Which just sounds dirty.